Blog Talk Radio.
Studios here in Washington, D.C., and this morning we're joined by Dr. Thomas D. Jones, and we have to put the doctor up front there because Tom is more than just a former NASA shuttle astronaut. He's a scientist, he's written several books, he's a pilot, and is a spacewalker. He led three spacewalks to install the centerpiece of the International Space Station last time he was up in the sky, the American Destiny Laboratory. And in all, Tom, you spent over 50 days in space, is that right?
About 53, if you round up.
Thanks for being on the show this morning. It's great to have you.
Morning, Bert.
Now, lots of kids, Tom, dream of being an astronaut. They play astronaut when they're little. You know, we were talking off the air about my 3.5-year-old son, and when we're on the swing set in the backyard, he likes to play astronaut. But you actually went from playing astronaut to actually doing it. Tell me how that happened.
It takes a long time, and I think the key is to have the dream. If you are 10 years old, like I was once, and you dream of being a space traveler, well, then you use that dream to propel you forward. And I think in the great majority of successful astronauts that I worked with, it's folks who had a desire to do this. The key was imagination, the dream that they had a chance to reach this goal. And that informed what they did in school as children, and informed what they did in high school, chose their careers in college. And I think, you know, everybody's a realist, knowing that it's going to be tough to get to be an astronaut. But if you've got the goal to shoot for, it really gives your life a template. And so I always decided that whatever I did in life, whatever career I chose, whatever job phase I was in, I would try to choose it so I could get closer to that job of being an astronaut. And then eventually, you know, the brakes fell my way, got a little bit of luck, and I wound up living my dream about 30 years after I first started it. But I had a lot of fun along the way. It didn't seem like 30 years.
It must have been quite an amazing achievement at the end after 30 years of preparing for it. Did you just look around? Was there that oh, wow moment where you went, my God, it's actually happened. I'm actually here.
I had lots of little oh, wow moments along the way. When I was an Air Force jet pilot, that was part of that adventure and that move towards the sky. And then later, working at a telescope in Hawaii, doing my doctoral dissertation as a space scientist, you know, being on top of an extinct volcano and looking at the universe through a big telescope, that was something else. Then training as an astronaut, a brand new astronaut, in astronaut school, if you will, down in Houston, they put you in a spacesuit and dunk you in the water, and you're in the simulated condition of weightlessness, and looking at myself in a spacesuit like that was another one of those wow moments. And then
sure.
Finally, you wind up on the launch pad for your first trip into space, and it's truly a gut check moment, a life assessment moment when you look around and you say, this is really going to happen for the first time. And then after liftoff, 8.5 minutes later, wound up in orbit, and the next moment was the real crowner, and that was when I pulled off my spacesuit glove and let it float in front of me just after the main engines of the shuttle shut down, and this huge smile spread over my face as I realized that I was really there.
Wow.
After dreaming about it for so many years. But as I said earlier, it didn't seem like 29 years. It seemed like just a series of great adventures that led me steadily towards that, and a lot of obstacles to overcome along the way. That's another thing I tell kids today, is that you can't give up the first time you encounter a bump in the road or a roadblock. You have to find a way around that, and I certainly had my share.
All right. Now, tell me, we're talking with Dr. Tom Jones is a former NASA shuttle astronaut. Tell me about some of those obstacles, maybe a big one that really stood in your way that you had to overcome.
I think probably the biggest disappointment I had along the way was a professional one. When I finished pilot training in 1978, I spent a whole year learning how to fly jets for the Air Force and did a pretty good job in my pilot training class. And back then, of course, in the mid-70s, NASA was mostly hiring test pilots to be astronauts. Certainly all the Apollo astronauts, except one geologist, were all test pilots by background. And so that's the path I thought I had to follow and was keen on tracking myself. So I wanted to be a jet fighter pilot and then work my way towards test pilot school and then get the Air Force to send me to NASA as an astronaut. And after that year of pilot training, there's a big moment when everybody gathers their class, receives their assignments. And as I stood up to receive my assignment that night, I was just crushed when I received the assignment to fly a B-52 bomber, a big 8-engine bomber that had been flying for 20 years already, considered an ancient, slow, sluggish airplane. And
sure.
When I was given that assignment, I just was destroyed. I thought that was the end of my dreams to get into space, because no one would take a bomber pilot and send him into space one day, certainly not as a test pilot candidate. And I was really, really destroyed for a couple of days. But then I found out, surprisingly, that flying that airplane for the next 5 years, the B-52, gave me the chance to practice being a good team member, a crewmate, a crew member on my crew of six. And eventually, from co-pilot, I moved up to aircraft commander, and I began to lead a group of six people. And so that experience was very close to what the space shuttle finally gave me in terms of teamwork and experience and leadership. So I think it was a great gift, and I didn't give up. After that initial shock and disappointment, I didn't give up and kept trying to figure out other ways I could get to this job of flying in space.
Dr. Tom Jones is our guest, a former NASA shuttle astronaut this morning. And if you'd like to talk with Tom, the telephone line to call is 718-506-1944, 718-506-1944. It's a free call in the New York City metropolitan area. You can also send your questions into us in the chat room on the Blog Talk Radio Network on WAMS Radio. Tom, was there a most surprising thing that has happened to you in your career so far, whether it includes the time in space or otherwise? I would imagine that there's so much preparation that goes into space travel, there are not going to be a lot of surprises, but was there a big surprise?
I think the biggest surprise I had was the level of work that has to go on in space flight. Well, we see the little clips of people working in space. They're floating around. They're having their lunch on the ceiling. They're smiling because it is a great, fun adventure and experience. And I did smile almost all the time I was up there. But I think I was surprised by the intensity of the work. And what that means is that you are trained to go and do a job up in space. And because of the expense of getting there and the limited time that the space shuttle can spend up in space, you know, something like 2 weeks or so, the flight planners, they cram every moment of your schedule with some kind of productive work that needs to be done, whether it's building the space station or operating a scientific instrument, looking back at the Earth, or launching or retrieving a satellite. Every day, from the time you get up until the time you close your eyes to go to sleep, is just a flat-out sprint to get everything done. And you are a member of a team, so there are people helping you. It's a group effort, so you feel part of a group, elbow to elbow, working through these problems. So you're not alone, but the work just never lets up. And it was very much a gift to find the space of an hour during a 2-week mission to just relax, be able to look out the window, and think about what all this space travel meant to you personally. I rarely got a chance to do that, but I was lucky enough to. And by the end of every one of my four trips in space, Burke, I was ready for a vacation.
Oh, I bet. Yeah. Yeah. It's not space tourism, it doesn't sound like.
No, and that's, of course, I think a good development that people will be heading into space on their own. First, on these suborbital hops where, you know, you only have about 10 minutes in weightlessness. But eventually people will be going to orbit, and I really envy them the chance to be in space for 3, 4, 5 days perhaps, where they don't have a schedule just driving them forward, and they can actually just look out and contemplate the Earth, the sky up above, those millions of stars they can see, and just really enjoy the human side of the experience. That's something that I had to really hunt for.
You know, lots of us, Tom, when we think about space travel, you think about what you see in the movies. You think about the right stuff, or you think about Apollo 13. And Apollo 13 and what happened with Jim Lovell was enough to scare me from space travel. Was there a scary moment for you as an astronaut, something that really made your heart skip a beat?
I don't think I had any life and death moments in space. Fortunately, all of my missions were successful. The equipment functioned perfectly for the most part. And the kinds of failures we did have, we usually had a backup piece of equipment that we could substitute for it. So nothing got inhibited by equipment failures, except one thing. That was my third mission. And it wasn't a life and death moment, but we did have a mechanical failure that led to the cancellation of the spacewalk that I was supposed to do with my friend Tammy Jernigan. And what this meant to our mission was the loss of a chance to practice some exercises, some rehearsals of how we would build the space station just a couple of years down the line. And that lost work, fortunately, was made up about a year later. So in the big picture of things, this was just a temporary setback that was later recovered by NASA with another shuttle flight. But for me personally, this mechanical failure that led to the hatchway outside being jammed shut so we could not do our spacewalk was an immense personal disappointment. And so, yes, I was already an astronaut. Yes, I'd already flown two times. But you always want to do the best thing or the top experience as an astronaut. And spacewalking is certainly at the top of my list. And so to be disappointed and be denied the chance to play in the big game after training for a whole year for that was really a big disappointment. And it led us on the crew to feel that we had somehow failed in terms of what the cause was. We found out after we got back home that it was a human error that led to a piece of debris, a small screw being jammed in the hatch mechanism where we couldn't reach it or fix it. So it was not our fault, but we sure felt glum about the lost spacewalks. The two that were canceled on that mission gave us a little bit of disappointment. It wasn't until two or three days after that in space that our spirits rebounded and we realized that our science mission was going perfectly. We were doing a good job with the material that we had, and we were doing our responsibilities and fulfilling those. And I think our spirits bounced back. By the time we landed, we felt we'd had a great trip.
Dr. Tom Jones is our guest. We're talking about his trips to space as a NASA shuttle astronaut. And Tom has gone on to be an author of several books. And he's also going to be the special VIP guest at author Homer Hickam's October Sky Festival in Colwood, West Virginia, Saturday, October the 4th. And Tom, Homer was an astronaut trainer during his time with NASA. Did you and Homer work together? How did you two come in contact with one another?
Homer came pretty close to me and vice versa. He was working down in Huntsville, Alabama at the Marshall Space Center. I did a lot of training down there preparing some techniques for repairing the Hubble telescope, for example, which is a mission that's just going to come up here in the coming months. And Homer was instrumental in training some of the astronaut crews on the work that they would do in space. I visited those facilities and didn't actually meet him until after he had written his great book, Rocket Boys, and later made into the movie October Sky. And so that's when I first became aware of Homer and then found out that he had, in fact, had trained some of my later shuttle crewmates. We actually had overlapped to that extent. So the people that Homer worked with down there in Huntsville were the people that I trained with as well. And then, of course, back in Houston is where most of the astronaut training goes on. So we moved in the same circles, and it was neat to encounter someone who felt the magic of spaceflight as much as Homer did, to read his work and then finally get to meet him in person. I'm looking forward to the Colwood weekend.
The October Sky Festival is coming up. We're talking to the VIP special guest this year, astronaut Tom Jones.
Hi, I'm Homer Hickam, author of the best-selling book Rocket Boys, which became the movie October Sky. Join me and the rest of the Rocket Boys at 10 a.m. Saturday, October the 4th for the 10th annual October Sky Festival in the town where it all began, Colwood, West Virginia. Our special guests this year include NASA shuttle astronaut, author, and Fox News space commentator Tom Jones, Grace Corrigan, mother of Challenger astronaut Krista McAuliffe, and Dreema Denver, widow of Gilligan's Island star Bob Denver. Busloads of folks from all over the USA come to Colwood for the day-long family festival, which includes a parade, great food, live music, and this year, a Colwood school reunion. Plus, rocket boys and girls from across the country will be shooting off rockets all day from the real Cape Colwood. Miss Riley would be proud. So bring your family and join us for the 10th annual October Sky Festival, 10 a.m. Saturday, October the 4th in Colwood. You can find out more at homerhickam.com.
WAMS Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're back with former shuttle astronaut Tom Jones, who is appearing at the October Sky Festival Saturday, October 4th in Colwood, West Virginia, where it all began with Homer Hickam and the Rocket Boys. Lo, those many years ago, they went on to win the National Science Fair in 1960 with their rocket design. And, of course, the best-selling book, Rocket Boys, was made into the major motion picture, October Sky, surely inspiring millions of youngsters in their interest in space. And, Tom, you'll actually be shooting off rockets with a lot of those kids down in Colwood.
that'll be a lot of fun. I got my start myself in rocketry, shooting off model rockets as an eighth grader, and that's something I've taught my own kids to do, and so I'm looking forward to looking at some future astronauts' rockets out there in Goldwood.
And, you know, there are busloads of kids that come from all over the country, as far away as the state of Washington, to actually participate in this thing. And you mentioned your youth, and let's talk about that a little bit. Where did you grow up, and how did you grow up? What does the DNA of a future astronaut look like as a youngster?
I think that had a lot to do with the career path I chose, because I grew up on the east side of Baltimore, Maryland, in a town called Essex, right next to a big aerospace factory owned by the Martin Company. And in the early 60s, they were building rockets to send Gemini astronauts into space in 1965 and 66. So as a Cub Scout, I actually got to go down on a field trip or an open house to the factory and saw two of these Titan rockets being built as part of the space race. And I thought, wow, it's right here in my hometown. And it was really a special moment seeing these 200-foot-tall missiles that would later carry people into space. And I thought, well, I'd love to ride on one of those machines myself, because they're the most sophisticated, complex machines anyone's ever built, and they're taking them to places no one's ever gone before. And I thought that was a great combination.
And being right there, and I'm sure, made it seem that much more achievable and real. It's not something people around the world somewhere else are doing. It's in your backyard.
It's true. And my parents really encouraged that. So did my teachers. They didn't say, oh, you're just a dreamer, it'll never happen. Instead, they encouraged me to find out more about the job of being an astronaut. And in 1970, I went down on a family vacation to Cape Canaveral. And though I didn't see one of the Apollo launches to the moon, that was what was going on at the time. I think we were waiting for Apollo 14 to fly. Saw the rocket, the Saturn V, in the assembly hangar, the vehicle assembly building there. And I think at that age, in high school, I said I could actually see a way for me to, you know, join the Air Force, become a pilot, and eventually do this job myself.
When you became an astronaut and you joined this very elite group of people, and gosh, I guess there are probably less than, 500 Americans who've gone into space.
Altogether, I think only about 470 or so human beings have gone into space, the majority Americans, but it's quite an exclusive club. It's going to change. As space tourism begins, we're going to have more and more people at least get a brief taste of what it's like to be in space. But it's actually a great privilege being able to represent the U.S. in space on the shuttle.
And when you do meet some of these people, you mentioned Apollo 14 being prepared for launch when you were a high school kid, you know, down at Cape Canaveral, and you meet some of those legendary early astronauts, you know, the Buzz Aldrins, the Jim Lovells, the Michael Collins. What goes through your mind when you think, man, I'm toe-to-toe with these guys?
Well, it's very gratifying to be greeted as a colleague of one of these gentlemen. And, of course, they were my heroes growing up. And this week I'm working with Rusty Schweikert.
Is that right?
He was on Apollo 9. He was the first co-pilot of the lunar module back in 1969 on its first flight in space. So, you know, to actually work with someone like that shoulder to shoulder on, in this case, preventing an asteroid strike on the Earth, or back in Houston being able to work with John Young from Apollo 16, the first commander of the space shuttle, in fact. He walked on the moon and later commanded the shuttle. To be actually in the same airplane cockpit or the simulator with him, wow, what a pinch-me kind of moment that is.
It's got to be just unbelievable. And let's talk a little bit about that. You mentioned that you're working on a project to keep asteroids from hitting the Earth. What does the life of a post-astronaut look like? It must be difficult to sort of duplicate that high from early in your life, but it sounds like you're doing some pretty exciting stuff now. What have you been keeping yourself busy with since you switched from being shuttle astronaut to former shuttle astronaut?
Oh, thanks. Most people don't have too much trouble getting onto the next phase of their career when they leave flying in space. They've got a lot of opportunities, a lot of interest that probably have been put on the back burner while they've been astronauts. Now they want to pick those up and go full tilt with them. Some become aerospace company executives. Some stay with the government and work in management at NASA or other parts of the government. And that's a career path that several of my friends have chosen. I'm a scientist by training, so I wanted to do some writing about the experience of being in space and stay involved with the technical side of spaceflight. So I do consulting now for some contractors and some NASA work. So I'm able to do that professionally on the technical side. And this asteroid project is actually technical, but it's a volunteer project. In other words, the Association of Space Explorers, our group of our society of flown astronauts and cosmonauts, is involved in sponsoring this effort to submit a plan to the United Nations for consideration about how we can decide what to do in case we discover a hazardous asteroid streaking towards the Earth. And right now we have the technology that can actually divert an asteroid from hitting us, if we made the decision to do it. The problem is there's no mechanism for making that decision, and that's probably our big weakness, is that we have not figured out as a world how to deal with a space hazard that has been operating here for billions of years and will potentially do us in if we don't have a plan to deal with it.
And, you know, that leads us to a question that we have up on the chat room blog here, WAMS Radio. And a gentleman in Alabama wants to know about the whole federal funding piece and how that plays into what's going to happen with NASA moving forward. You know, with this current economic crisis, what are your thoughts on funding for NASA?
It's a really tough time for our space agency. We consider ourselves the leader in space flight, and I think we've proven that over the last few decades, certainly with the moon landings and then with our long history with the space shuttle. But right now, NASA's in a budgetary box that is not easy to get out of. The country's deficit makes it very hard for lawmakers to expand the budget, and yet NASA has been given a number of very difficult tasks to finish up the construction of the space station and fly the shuttle for a couple of more years until that job is done and do it safely, which is a challenge in and of itself. And yet, at the same time, to build brand new spaceships that are capable of getting us to the station and then eventually out to the moon and beyond, and to take on all those tasks at once with just the same budget, a flat budget, over the last 10 years has been an almost impossible job. And we're seeing now the effects of that, and I hope that the next administration will allot more resources to NASA and bump up its 0.7% of the federal budget, bump that up just a couple of tenths of a percent so that we can actually do all these difficult things that we've set for ourselves. We're Americans. We can do it if we have the proper resources and will, and it's just a question of finding that political will.
You know, your friend Homer Hickam, who you'll appear with at the October Sky Festival on Saturday, October 4th there in Colwood, has gone on record in opinion pieces in the Los Angeles Times, the Wall Street Journal, and other places, is saying he thinks the shuttle itself should be shelved. And I would imagine you probably would respectfully disagree.
Actually, no. I think it's very smart. The Columbia Accident Investigation Board realized how fragile a machine the shuttle is. And it's nearing 30 years in service. It's got some vulnerabilities that cannot be designed out by just upgrades or repairs. So the shuttle's time should be limited, and we should retire it as quickly as possible because it's so expensive to operate the shuttle that it's taking up money that could be used for the development of its own replacement and the plans to go back out into deep space to the moon, the asteroids nearby, and eventually Mars. So we need to see the shuttle move rapidly off the stage, and yet because the country has slowed down its commitment to space and we've had no growth in NASA's budget to develop the follow-on ships, we're going to be in this position starting in about 2011 where we can't get any astronauts from America into space unless we rent seats on a Russian rocket. And that's a box that we've gotten ourselves in by neglecting, I think, our commitment to space funding for the last 5 years.
I can't imagine that the American people would stand for that should it actually come to that point.
Well, they'll scratch their heads and they'll wonder, how did we get into this position and how do we get out of it? And the history is interesting, but now is the time to actually look forward and say, what do we need to do to avoid this situation or minimize it? And so that's what the new administration and Congress will have to deal with.
One more space question, then I want to ask you about your books. We're talking to NASA former shuttle astronaut Tom Jones. Tom, should the U.S. push on towards Mars, and if so, how achievable is that in your and my lifetime?
Well, I think it's actually technically doable if we take small steps that steadily ramp up our experience. And so the first step is to commit to getting out beyond Earth orbit where we've been for the last 35 years. And go out into deep space. Now, we might circle the moon. We might actually decide to land on the moon if there's a good reason for being there scientifically or to find resources. But by building up our deep space experience, maybe to the moon first and then to the nearby asteroids, which are just a little farther away, those asteroids are rich with resources, have great scientific appeal. That will increase our experience to the point where sometime in the 2030s we might be able to actually commit to an expedition to Mars. Now, the reason for going to Mars is because it harbors secrets as to where life may have come from in the solar system and whether or not Earth is unique in being a harbor for life. So we'd like to get out there eventually to follow up our robot discoveries and grapple with those really deep and difficult questions of biology in our solar system and the universe. But it's going to take a sustained commitment. And to try to keep a space program moving steadily forward, administration after administration is something that we haven't tackled in this country. And so that sustained commitment is probably going to require a lot of international cooperation, and I think a chance for people to personally get involved through commercial space travel as well as government exploration.
And that'll help with the funding issue as well. Tom, are we the only ones out there?
Oh, no, no. I think that certainly with 100 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy alone where we live, we'll find other planets. More than 300 have been discovered thus far. One or two will soon be found to have the conditions favorable for life. Mars is almost actually habitable in some ways today. So we'll find the abodes where life might exist, and then the challenge will be to try to find out evidence of whether life is actually there. I think within our lifetimes, Burke will hear a message from the stars out there, the planets where intelligent beings are transmitting their own presence out into space.
Wow. It's an amazing thing to think about, and you've had your own very amazing part of it. Former NASA shuttle astronaut Tom Jones has flown four times. He's done three bouts of skywalking, and he's a hell of a writer. You've written a new book called Hell Hawks that it takes you away from some of your space writing, like your great book Skywalking and The Complete Idiot's Guide to NASA. Hell Hawks is actually a World War II book.
That's right, and it's related to space, and they all stem from aviation technology. I've always loved reading about airplanes and, again, flying them later on in life. And this is a story about some of the greatest generations, some pilots and airmen who flew the great P-47 Thunderbolt against the Germans in World War II. It's a true story of an aerial band of brothers who fought the German army in support of the GIs on the ground. And Hell Hawks tells their story of how they fought from D-Day all the way through the fall of Germany. And without that aerial support that the men on the ground had at their call on the radio, I think the struggle against the Germans, the Nazis in Europe, would have been much, much more difficult and bloody. And these men did a key job in bringing victory that much more quickly. Without their support in the air, helping the GIs on the ground, we would have had a slugging match of horrendous proportions, and the outcome would have been much more in doubt. Probably we would not have been able to pull off the invasion of Europe. So it's a great story about meeting, interviewing, and putting the stories together of all these men who flew 63, 64 years ago to preserve our freedom.
You know, we're losing those guys so rapidly today. It's great that you were able to get to them, talk to them, and get your story on the printed page.
It was a great privilege.
NASA shuttle astronaut Tom Jones, it's going to be a great privilege to spend time with you at the 10th Annual October Sky Festival, Saturday, October 4th in Colwood, West Virginia. Thank you so much for taking time to be on WAMS Radio.
Thanks, Burke.
There's a West Virginia town on the map. Feels like it's hardly up from a nap. It's Colwood. Well, time goes by like it wants to stay, and the clouds move only when they're blown away from Colwood.
Colwood, West Virginia, where I grew up, was built for the purpose of digging out tons of coal that lay beneath it. My father, Homer Hickam, was the mine superintendent. Dad ruled the mine with an iron hand, and most people didn't like him for it. Mom ruled the house with an iron in her hand, and he didn't like her for it. Before I was born, Dad was expecting a daughter. So when I came along, he was clearly disappointed. Mom named me after him anyway, Homer Hadley Hickam Jr. Only Dad called me,
"Sonny, what are you up to now, boy?"
There's a job to be done down in the mine. First father, then son, and on down the line, they work for the good of Colwood. Make a decent living, then die from the ash. But the funeral's paid with the company cash. They do as they should in Colwood. Now each house in Colwood had a yard. Mom planted a rose garden in hers. She got dirt from the mountains by the sackful, and she was always rewarded with bushes of flowers that were like a breath of fresh air in Colwood.
Sonny, what are you up to now, boy?
But the folks are fine, and they do their best. Take what they're given, wouldn't ask for the rest if they could in Colwood. We had a small church in Colwood. The company hired the preacher, and over the years we had a few of them. Whatever denomination the preacher was automatically became all of ours. Before we became Methodists, we were Baptists. One year we were even some kind of Pentecostal and a little bit Jewish. If you talk the talk and your walk's the same, you can call your God by any name in Colwood.
But the dust is black and the air is brown, and if you live here, your life's the